noticing what qualities you're cultivating in this moment. And whatever beautiful, supportive qualities you're helping to be there, helping to grow. Allowing them to come with you in the transition. So as you make yourself as comfortable as you feel to, I just check, is there any adjustments we should make to the sound level or anything regards to that? Okay. So I always kind of feel a little bit shy to say it, but I have to overcome my English nature, but I just want to let you know that I really admire you for being here and for what you're doing. It's really beautiful and yeah, really inspiring that you're here practicing in this way. I just want to let you know I really, really appreciate it. I think it's pretty remarkable. And yeah, I would like to give a reflection this evening around quite an important word in the teachings, and this word is dukkha. So you know, it's this interesting quality that we get to meet in our practice, and you know, it's tricky with a word like that that you know we might choose not to translate it, for example. You know, it's a dukkha. But oftentimes there's some way, even then, it still kind of fits into our psychological space. It has a meaning for us. Yeah. Maybe kind of has a place in the collection of words and phrases that we live with. And I think there's a way of saying that it's quite important if we're doing these practices to really contemplate what does it mean? What does it mean? And there are quite a few translations kind of hanging around in the space. You know, you'll have your Hebrew translations, I know about my English translations. And I recently came across a quote from a Buddhist monk, he's an abbot, and also a translator of this language. And I'll just read you what he had to say. So this is Tanissaro Bhikkhu, also known as Ajahn Jeff, for those who might be interested. And he says, as soon as you think you've found the single best translation for the word, think again. For no matter how you describe dukkha, it's always deeper, subtler, and more unsatisfactory than that. And, you know, we can look in various directions, like where did this word fit at the Buddha's time, you know, or what resonates with us from the translations that we hear, and all of that, I think it's still going to be really, really valuable to remember. It's deeper. It's subtler. This is a path that leads beyond dukkha. It is the fading, the cessation, the bringing to the end of dukkha. So what is that? What is that? So let's take a funny route through this territory. And I want to share with you something that many of you will already know, and hopefully some of you won't. Okay. Would anyone like a translation, kind of a ongoing, rolling translation, or to sit with someone who occasionally we can turn to and check with words? Would that be helpful for anyone? Yeah? Okay, are you on board? Great. So anyone want to join that that space? That's fine, it's fine, it's good. Okay, so even if you've heard this story before and you think you know the answer, you can still answer. Right? It's not one of those kind of quizzes, right? But also, as you listen, think, feel, what makes sense to you in the way that you lead your life. And what we're going to play is Spot the Happiness. Right? The game is called Spot the Happiness, right? So there was a research study, has a bit of a setup, where they attached those anodes, I think they're called, those sensor things. Yeah, I don't know what they pick up exactly, electric signals or like, whatever. Huh? EEG? Uh-huh. So they're picking up electric. Okay. So electric stimulus on the person as a way of kind of getting a sense of peak excitement, happiness kind of experience. Yeah. And then they give the person whatever, a bunch of cash or a credit card or something to be able to go into a shop and buy something. Okay. Now, it really depends on your own personal relationship with shopping. If you think that, well, obviously there was no happiness at all because shopping is just pure dukkha, you know. But let's imagine that they pre-selected people who would have a happiness experience from finding something they like and buying it, okay? So you are that person, okay, if you weren't already. You go into the shop. We're looking for Spot the Happiness, right? You go into the shop, you see a bunch of stuff, you see something you like, and it looks like it's going to fit you or fit your life, and you try it, it's good, it fits. You go to the cashier, you hand it over, you give the cash, the credit card, whatever it is, and then you get the thing in your bag, and you walk out, you go home, right? Where do you think happiness peaks in that story? So I'm happy to take any answers. Anywhere. When people are paying, yeah, the exchange, the transaction. When they pull it out of the shelf, yep. Before they put the anodes on. No, sometime before. Oh, okay, but they weren't measuring them at that. What, you mean like maybe when they were given the credit card or something like this? Yeah, okay. When you share it with somebody, that's very sweet. That is really nice. Yeah, yeah. I reckon you're probably right. Yeah. Before entering the shop, okay. Right before you pay, and before you leave the shop. After you've left, you get more happy leaving. You don't like shopping. Nice, nice. Hmm? When you see it, yeah.
When you wear it
after you bought it, makes you the most happiness. Yeah, interesting. So I'll just tell you what this research says, and then I can hopefully kind of explain a little bit how that fits into the Dharma teachings. So this, you know, I haven't read all the studies on anode-covered people in shops, so I'm slightly what they call p-hacking. I'm just picking the story that fits my narrative. But what happened is, and those of you who got it right can feel so happy, it's in this moment where you know you're going to get it. So it's in that transaction that, you know, it's like before you've paid, that confidence, this is coming to me. There's no more, you know, wanting, there's no more demanding, there's no more I must. It just fades away, and now you've got it. And then, as we might know about our experiences, it drops away. Now what am I going to do with it? And this beautiful idea, share it with someone else, is very possibly the best thing that we can do with material things, right? Makes us happy. Then you see someone else wearing it, makes you happy. Oh, you look so good in that. You know, reminds us of that generosity, and it all feels good. Yeah. Getting things isn't as good as we thought it would be. Yeah. And so the Dharma teachings, many of you will know this, we're not going to do all of the Buddha's greatest hits tonight, but there is this kind of reference point to the first noble truth that dukkha occurs in existence. Yeah. The second noble truth is it occurs because it's a conditioned experience, and those conditions that we bring into bear, you know, kind of support it in being there. And some of those conditions are basically the hindrances, the greediness, the aversiveness, the restlessness, the agitation, the dullness, not really showing up to life. And all of those expressions are also contributing factors of what goes on there. When your greediness disappears, even that subtle greediness that doesn't maybe feel like greediness, I need a clothes and I see a nice one, I'm going to look nice, all of that. When that fades, happiness comes through. When dukkha fades, happiness arises. Kind of know that in our experience, right? Is there, so I kind of have two questions in regards to this. Like, one is, where is the maximum happiness? I think that's an interesting question to ask. The second question, which actually feels even more significant to me, is where did the happiness come from? Where did the happiness come from? Does that make sense as a question? Like, was it in the shop? Was it in the credit card? Was it attached to the anodes? You know, it's like, it seems to me that the happiness was released by the person who walked into the shop, which means they went into the shop with their own happiness and then decided to just let it come out somewhere near the till. Do you think that's what happened? I mean, I can't see where else it came from, but you can decide for yourself. Like, where does it come from? Sense of happiness. So basically, here's a way of understanding these teachings. This second noble truth that we had there is that dukkha is conditioned. When the conditions for dukkha are not there, something is released, a sense of freedom. That sense of freedom feels good, feels happy, it's less conditioned. Dukkha depends. Depends on what? Depends on behaviors, depends on ways of relating, it depends on unskillfulness. When that unskillfulness drops away, which it will eventually, because it's conditioned, it can't keep it up forever, we get tired, there's a release. Right? Dukkha depends and freedom deepens. Dukkha depends, but freedom deepens. When that dukkha disappears, we come into that space and say, I feel really good. Oftentimes, we only really get to experience it when, you know, the craving, the push and the pull on existence kind of like stops because I've gotten the thing I was pushing and pulling for, gotten that condition. I say, now I can relax. But these teachings are actually suggesting, what if we don't take that really long route around and actually just feel good now by dropping that pushing, that pulling, that demanding, that all of those conditions that support this. Yeah? And then we get a little bit of a taste of this third noble truth. There is an ending of dukkha. Yeah. Now, as we said, whatever we kind of conceive, the whole of this path is dependent on this walking of lessening dukkhas. Yeah. Ultimate dukkha might actually be very, very subtle. Important point to kind of remember. But any time we're in dukkha, we have to know this is conditioned, this is fabricated. There is something else I can do here. And use the wisdom, the practices that we've been exploring here. Yeah. So that we can have a slightly more easeful time with the conditions that are here that can give us an experience of dukkha, of distress, of stressfulness, of suffering, of unsatisfactoriness. Yeah. So you'll be familiar with, you know, these Dharma teachings, and you know, you might have various friends and dear people in your life who kind of ask you what it is that you're doing all the time with this meditation practice, or coming on retreats, or you know, depending how much of your time it's taking up, you know. And then they hear about this teaching that, you know, life is suffering, and it's like, why do you want to do that? And, you know, some people have said to me, oh, you know, the Buddha was really, didn't like life. You know, he thought all of life was suffering. Birth, he says, is suffering. And, you know, everything is suffering. Every day it's suffering. It's suffering. What a depressing thing to focus on. Shouldn't you just, you know, get through, enjoy shopping for a change, you know, enjoy the little things in life. But actually, it's not a teaching of disappointment. It's not a teaching of there is suffering. It's that this suffering is added on. And it depends on how you relate. There's a lovely quote of the Buddha, which I think most people would agree with. We should put it on our Tovana t-shirts or something. Which is, well, it may not work that well on a t-shirt. We could modify it. You'll never know. What, when I do it, leads to my long-term well-being and happiness? The question of a lifetime. What, when I do it, leads to my long-term well-being and happiness? So yesterday we talked about anicca. Today we practice anicca. And so all this talk of long-term well-being and happiness maybe seems a little bit, you know, like, nothing lasts. What do you mean? But actually the long-term well-being and happiness is for something that is not dependent on the things that come and go. It's dependent on the way that we relate. It's dependent on what we cultivate. Sometimes this path gets called liberation through non-clinging. Yeah. Or we could say there's more liberation the less we demand. It's more freedom, less demands. More freedom, less dukkha. When we sat here just before, we just took 10 minutes. We could play around with our experience. We have these tools, these ways, open the space, encourage the sensitivity, bring in the kindness. Yeah, see the Vedana. Notice it's all anicca. All of these things encouraging us to be able to move from the gross, entangled kind of condition a human being can easily trip themselves into being. Yeah, to something subtler, something a little bit easier to be with, something a little bit more delightful. I sometimes find myself feeling a little bit like a magician. Yeah, like magicking, a little bit of peacefulness. Maybe it's really magical and profound, really like a magic trick. And sometimes it's just like, hey, I found your card. You know, that kind of magic trick. Yeah, you counted all the cards, it's fine. But, nice. That's a little bit better. I like that. that we can make it a little bit better, and that can be enough. Just thinking for a moment whether to open a more tricky area or not, but I think it's helpful. Oh, you want tricky? Okay. So, should we? Should we play with our experience in this way? Is it right to? Yeah. Are we escaping from things? Yeah. Are we escaping from the painful? You know, it's our path become a path of escape. Yeah? When we understand the potential of our ability to change what is appearing here, I think you have to be aware that this is a great power that we have to use it well. Yeah? That nothing exists separate from the way that we relate to it. It depends on how I relate to it. Yeah. It depends on you paying attention to it for it to exist. Yeah. Does it exist? Like that? Does a tree make a sound when it, you know, falls in the wood or something like this? Yeah. It's like if someone isn't listening to it, someone isn't hearing it. And if this experience arises and it's not met, it's not held, it's not connected with, what's going on there? Yeah. There's a saying, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. Yeah. And it's interesting, it's kind of entered the global understanding, and it turns out you can trace it all the way back to Spider-Man. Yeah. And with great power comes great responsibility. Shri, Shri, Spider-Man. We have to question, like, what are we doing with our practice? And I wonder at times if, you know, if we don't bring enough metta into our practice, enough kindness, enough allowing, enough welcoming, we might end up just kind of zapping things. You're a Nietzsche. And they kind of fade away, right? It's like, hey, nothing there. You're barely here at all. That kind of spirit, yeah, or like the Vedana kind of thing. It's like, oh, we're not doing unpleasant Vedanas today. I'm paying attention to pleasant Vedanas. I'm choosing what feels wholesome, what feels helpful. Right? And maybe that subtle aversion, it's okay. It's okay that it's there, yeah. It's okay, so I don't, you know, I can really lessen the amount of painfulness in my life. But I was recalling, you may already know this if you've, you know, checked out these kind of teachings quite a lot. So there's kind of a famous turning of the wheel sutta that the Four Noble Truths find themselves sitting in. You might just kind of skip to the heart of it and miss the beginning part, which is quite an interesting part where the Buddha kind of lays out this middle way. What is the middle way? Yeah. This middle way between indulgence and kind of punishment, self-punishment. Like indulging in sense pleasures as a prince who could have anything, and then, you know, kind of putting the body through torture, really, to kind of get to the truth and realizing you don't get it in either of these realms. But it's this bringing together of what feels necessary, what feels helpful, what feels supportive. And finding out that it's actually possible to find a relief, to find a happiness, to find a freedom in the midst of things through skillful ways of relating, ways of meeting experiences. our friend and teacher Rob would say, you know, the Buddha talks about this middle path, but if you kind of look at his life, you think, what an extremist. I mean, that was the middle. It seems really pretty austere, pretty fierce kind of existence. So we each probably have to find our own middle way, yeah, within our range, finding that way of like, what is supportive, what's helpful. And so it means to explore and to discover for ourselves what ways of relating to experience, what ways of relating to existence, what ways of relating to myself, to this moment, to the things around me, lead to suffering, lead to distress, lead to disharmony, lead to agitation. And when we see what they are, then we really have to ask ourselves, is that what I want? Is that what I want to do? Do I understand that there are other possibilities and that I'm still going to choose to do that one? That's not good for me, it's not good for others, it's not good. Doesn't feel good, doesn't look good, doesn't smell good. Just one more time I'm going to do it, okay? Just for old time's sake, whatever it is. See the habit, see the pattern, remember the possibilities, and maybe we just refrain. And we say, this is unsatisfactory. And there is a subtle aversion to repeating that pattern, a skillful aversion to repeating that pattern. And I think the best translation for this that I've ever heard is a holy disinterest, a holy disinterest in following that path. Yeah, it's not a rejection. It's a holy disinterest of repeating that pattern, reacting that way, responding that way. That's also Rob's. What?
Choser inyan mekudash.
Oh, I wasn't listening. So, we could say that there are ways of relating to experience which are dissatisfactory. They pull us away from satisfaction. Yeah. And it's helpful to see that. Ah, that way of living. But things themselves cannot be dissatisfying. The things, the appearances that we experience cannot be dissatisfying. You know, they're attributed this way by the Vedana from the mind that perceives them. Oh, you are painful. You are pleasant. And I didn't want to say too much about it, but when we say that the Vedana, you know, the thing is empty of having a Vedana of this or of that, you can choose to see things as having a different Vedana. Yeah? There are practices that we do, metta is one of them, that support what we call a malleability of perception. Vedana is an aspect, a part of a perception, an appearance. Something comes to you and you see and it's like, ah, you are unpleasant. And we've had this experience, like a fly lands on my face. Ah, this is unpleasant. And we stop and we wait and we see and it becomes pleasant because of the way that we relate to it, right? So we see, oh no, fly lands, no, that's pleasant. Maybe big wasp, big hornet lands, oh no, no, no. We say, no, that as well. It's also pleasant. And I really convince myself, like a magician convinces us that they really did do that. Of course they didn't. It's just magic. So this is also magic. Make something appear that wasn't already there. Yeah. Things themselves cannot be either satisfying or dissatisfying. Okay, I think, yeah, my advisors say that I shouldn't answer that question until my lawyer is present. We'll take questions tomorrow morning. But yes, it's a good question. But the point here, and let's finish the talk and then you can see if you want to come on board with this idea. One of the most radical things, I think, that the Buddha says, and we have to be kind of careful when we deal with the radical. Radical means down at the root of something. And if we pull something out by the root, then it doesn't get to live anymore. Yeah. So you've got to be careful. Great power, Spider Woman. Yeah. Remembering, okay, let's be delicate. So in addition to all that the Buddha said about the Four Noble Truths and the dukkha that's kind of sitting in there, we might say, oh yeah, it's the dukkha that's conditioned by these ways of looking, all this kind of conditioning stuff. He also says, sabbe sankhara dukkha. All appearances are dukkha, all of them. Anything that appears is dukkha. Yeah? Now, honestly, that's a pretty negative guy. I think we need to find a new person to follow. Yeah? That's what this talk is about. All appearances are dukkha. So the point, back to Tanisaro Bhikkhu's point about the translations, right? It's deeper, it's subtler. It's not that. It's not what you think it is. It's something else. Something else. It's more unsatisfactory than that. Okay? And I think that he's dropping a breadcrumb for us. Anything that arises due to conditions is dukkha. Sankhara is a formation, a fabrication, a coming into being. Anything that comes into being is dependent on other things to appear. It's dependent on the heart, the mind, the attention, the awareness. Right? It might be dependent on all other kinds of things in the world to appear this way. Many of these things also work both ways, you know. All dukkha is fabricated. All fabrications are dukkha, so all dukkhas are fabricated. Yeah? If you remember your logic class, do you do logic in Israel? Not so much? No? Didn't feel like it, honestly. But, yeah. So, all fabrications are dukkha. So that's everything that appears, right? Now, these teachings are so skillful when you tune into them. I know I've been giving the Buddha a hard time, but I really admire this Buddha. You know, I really admire these teachings. They dance really playfully, really kind of poetically, but also really kind of precisely, really accurately, threading through neither this nor that. And they're kind of satisfying on a certain level, even when they're pointing out how everything is unsatisfactory. It's, take refuge in this. It's really nice. Sabbe sankhara dukkha also points towards the freedom. Yeah? Something that is not conditioned, something that is not fabricated, would also not be dukkha. Yeah? So this is kind of pointing at the path, goal, this nibbana, this non-experience that is not of time, it's not of a perception, it's not of an experience. It's the fading of all of that. And that the Buddha found, you know, this unspeakably refined peace, you know, deeply nourishing. And so this nibbana is, I'm going to say a phrase, it's not going to work, but the rest, for all the rest. Have you heard of Nisargadatta Maharaj, the lovely Indian teacher of our era, you know, it's like, And there's kind of a famous saying that he had that got translated as, so he spoke in Hindi and they translated it, wisdom. Wisdom tells me I'm nothing. Love tells me I'm everything. And between these two, my life flows. And then this American poet, Dharma teacher, adventurer into the realms of death and near death, Stephen Levine, really beautiful teacher. I really wholeheartedly recommend him. And also a great poet. Actually reworked that phrase. Also changed the order. He says, love tells me I am everything. And wisdom tells me I'm everything else. And I think that gets even closer, you know, as a translation. Love tells me I'm everything, inseparable from everything. And wisdom tells me I'm everything else.
Start whispering.
I've got you. I do that. I do that. No, it's fine. And so I just want to share with you that the way that we hold appearances, you know, that we spoke about, that we tend to think that in some way there is happiness in things or unhappiness in things. And it's quite a helpful practice to extract ourselves from that opinion and to see that all things neither contain satisfaction nor dissatisfaction. And for this reason, I just want to take a little bit of your time with etymology, like the meaning of words, what words mean. So, satisfactory. Factories, we know what they are, right? Places where things get made, yeah? And satis is enough, like, or enoughness, feeling enough. Satisfactory is something that will make, and it's always about me, but make me feel enough. At last, I am enough. That would be satisfactory, yeah. No thing can do that, right? No thing can do that. Where did the happiness come from in the shop? Yeah, it didn't come from the thing. No thing is satisfactory. But also, dissatisfactory. So we have the factory, and we have the enoughness, and we have the dis, the pull away from. The factory that pulls you away from enoughness. Equally, no thing can do that either. So it's not that things are satisfactory or that they are dissatisfactory, but they are actually unsatisfactory, which means they neither contain satisfaction nor dissatisfaction. And we can hold them in so many different ways. We can hold them with holy disinterest. And allow them just to be, nothing demanded of them. We can hold them with metta, welcome and allow and nourish. Yeah. Shaka this evening was laughing at me for eating rice cakes because they don't taste of anything. And I said, yeah, but they're just waiting for a way of relating. You know, and then they become, they're so fantastic. Or they could become, really nothing good about them at all. But they are unsatisfactory. And I really love that about them. And everything's unsatisfactory. Everything, including me, including you, unsatisfactory. Which, for me, it really takes a lot of the weight out, knowing that I don't need to satisfy you. And you don't have to satisfy me. But the way that we relate to each other is full of potential. Yeah. full of the possibility space. So what are you going to do with your perception, with your ways of relating? What's going to support you? What's going to guide you? What do you want to see more of? What do you want to support? So this path, we're moving from reactivity to a release, or to a responsibility, our ability to respond in the ways that serve us, serve others, bring freedom. So we can remember, if we call something unsatisfactory, it's not a rejection. It's lowering those expectations and demands on it to do something it cannot do from its own side. So tomorrow we'll bring this more into the practice, and at that point, I hope, if it doesn't now, it will make more sense. Yeah. And then we'll be able to open out and see how that practice can support us, or if it's not for now. We can put it aside if we have enough. But we'll decide that, you know, from the experience, from the knowing. But if you'd like to have an unsatisfactory minute together, we could close with that.